Hello, everyone in the US, Israel, Palestine, and other places in the world. I am Lenny Grob, a Vice President for Partners for Progressive Israel. Welcome to this latest installment of Conversations with Israel and Palestine, a series of informational webinars that bring voices from Israel and Palestine to an American and international audience, providing an important link between progressives in the Middle East and those outside. Before I hand over today's discussion to the moderator, let me note that Partners for Progressive Israel is an American not-for-profit organization dedicated to the achievement of a durable and just peace between Israel and its neighbors, and believes in the need to ensure civil rights, equality, and social justice for all of Israel's inhabitants. Partners seeks to deepen Americans' understanding of Israel's complexities, so they can better advocate for a progressive Israeli future. We're glad to be bringing this webinar to all of you for free. If you like it and want more programming like this, please visit our website at progressiveisrael.org and make a contribution. You'll also note on Partners' website that we'll be offering a virtual trip to Israel and Palestine, our annual symposium that takes place over the course of 7 Sundays during the months of July and August. Now, let me briefly introduce today's speaker, Mossi Raz, and our moderator, interviewer, J.J. Goldberg. You'll find complete bios on our website. Mossi Raz is a member of Knesset for the Meretz Party, elected earlier this year. He previously served as a Knesset member from 2000 to 2003 and from 2017 to 2019. Mossi is a lifelong political activist promoting Arab-Jewish coexistence in Israel, an end to the occupation, and environmental sustainability. In the past, he served as Secretary General of Peace Now, as Deputy Director General of Givat Chaviva, an NGO promoting a shared society for Arabs and Jews within Israel, and as co-founder of the binational Palestinian-Israeli radio station, Kol HaShalom. I also want to note that Mossi has always been a close friend and colleague of ours in Partners. J.J. Goldberg, whose name will be known to many of us, is an award-winning journalist and lecturer. He is editor emeritus of the Jewish Daily Forward, where he served as editor-in-chief from 2000 to 2007. J.J. has served as U.S. Bureau Chief of the Jerusalem Report and managing editor of the New York Jewish Week. His writing has appeared in the New York Times, Los Angeles Times, NBCNews.com, Haaretz, and many other forums. His books include Jewish Power Inside the American Jewish Establishment and Builders and Dreamers, A History of Labor Zionist Youth in America. And finally, before I hand things over to JJ, let me briefly set the scene with regard to some of what is to come. We look forward to hearing MK Mossi Raz's thoughts, in particular about the recent war between Israel and Hamas and about the friction in Jerusalem that preceded it. Of special interest will be a discussion of the intercommunal ethnic violence within Israel that occurred simultaneously. I'm sure that our audience will also be concerned to hear thoughts about the fallout from the March elections in Israel, including the election of the extreme right-wing Kahanist Knesset members. And with only 8 days remaining in Yair Lapid's mandate to form a government, we'll be very interested to hear Mossi address Lapid's prospects for success in having more than 6 parties join together in what's being called a coalition for change that would remove Bibi Netanyahu from power. And of course, there'll be interest in the proceedings of Netanyahu's trial, and we'll want to hear about ongoing threats to Israel's democracy. So there'll be much, much to talk about during the webinar. Take it away, JJ.
Thank you, Lenny. As he said, we're going to have a discussion of the current situation in Israel and in Palestine and how it impacts on the rest of us. You all have heard about who Mossi is. Let me just point out, I'm going to be talking with, interviewing Mossy for about 40 minutes. And then we'll open it up to questions from you folks. You can pose your questions anytime you like. You can start right now by clicking on the Q&A button on the lower right-hand corner of your screen. If you don't see the Q&A button, then move your cursor a bit or touch your screen if that's the kind of device you have, and the Q&A thing will show up. Click it, and you'll see a box where you can ask your question. We'll be looking at them later on at about 1:40. So let's start right off with Mossy. You've been around for a long time. This war that just happened, has something fundamental changed, or is this just another round?
First, good afternoon. Good evening to those who are in Israel. When you ask if something fundamental has changed, you mean to the last 2 weeks?
Yes. Yeah, or is the last 2 weeks a reflection of something that's been going on that maybe we haven't noticed?
Yeah, I think that first we have to divide what happened in the last 2 weeks for two parts. The first one is the clash, the war between Israel and Gaza. Nothing is different in this issue. It's another round of violence that we had in the last 20 years. Every couple of years, every few years, we had the same thing. Hamas sent missiles to Israel. Missiles are war crime. Israel react in a very violent way. And then somebody is acting for rules for ceasefire. Usually those were the Egyptians. This time President Biden took part too. I'm happy for that. And then we wait for the next time because there are no negotiations. There is no a political agreement, nothing that we can say, okay, we can go. So we just wait. We say Hamas they are afraid of us. They are not. They say Israel are afraid of us. Israel is not. And it might happen again in a year or two, or seven, I don't know, but it will happen again. But the second thing is what happened inside Israel. And I think that in that way, this is the first time it happened. Cases of lynch that Palestinian citizens are doing to Jews, or the opposite. We have to be frank with ourselves, more Palestinian than Jews. Of course, there are reasons for that. The police is with the Jewish majority, and of course there are reasons, but this is the case. We didn't see that in the past, not in this level of violence. We did see in 20 years ago, in 2000, 21 years ago, we did see some clashes between communities, but not like that. In 2000, it was more clashes between the Palestinian citizens of Israel and the Israeli police. And 13 Palestinians were killed by the police. I have to say that this time, the police was pretty careful. There was one case in Umm al-Fahem that they shot to death a Palestinian. But in spite of the fact that the violence was not less than in 2000, they really tried not to kill people. Even when those people were violent. Sometimes they were criticized that when people were attacked, this Palestinian guy in Bat Yam or Jews in Acre or Lid or the synagogues in Lod, they were not. They were just disappeared. The police disappeared. So, but in this, if I'm talking about this arena, the fact but at the end of the day, Jews and Palestinians live together in this state, inside the state, citizens of the same state. And in some cities like Tel Aviv, Jaffa, like Jerusalem, like Lod, Ramleh, Akko, Haifa, Beersheba, they live together in the same city. And I think it's going to take time to go back to what we had before. We never had paradise here. But basically, Jews and Palestinians, when I'm talking about citizens, live together without violence, of course, with some cooperation, not enough, right? With a kind of Jewish supremacy, right? With not de facto, not the same rights for Palestinian minority, but they used to live together, and it's going to be to take time until Jewish citizens will feel free to go to Palestinian villages, cities, or even to mixed cities, and vice versa.
Let me throw out a thought here that until probably 20 years ago, till the Second Intifada, we would refer to the Palestinian citizens of Israel as Arab Israelis or Israeli Arabs. It's a conflict between Israel and the Palestinians. So when the Israeli Arabs became Israeli Palestinians, the lines in the conflict blurred. There's a growing, it seems to me, identification. I don't know how widespread it is among the Arab population to identify themselves as part and parcel of a single unit called the Palestinians. And I wonder, especially if there is a two-state solution, there will be Palestine and there will be Israel and there will be Palestinian Israelis. It seems to me that that might reduce the hope of reconciliation as the sense of otherness grows among the Israeli Palestinian Arab population.
On one hand, you're right. But on the other hand, I want to remind the history. Actually, we had the UN resolution in 1947, the separation resolution. Actually, the UN resolution was to establish two states, one of them Jewish, and the second one is Arab state, not a Palestinian state. And in those days, in 48, I'm not saying that there was no Palestinian nation, of course was, but they had a flag and so on, but most of the Palestinians refer to themselves as Arabs, not as Palestinians. And all the Jews refer to the Palestinians as Arabs, meaning they are the same like the other Arabs in the Arab states surrounding us and declared a war on the state of Israel, Egypt, Syria, Jordan, Lebanon, so on. Then, after the establishment of the state, we had a kind of differentiation because we had an Arab, Palestinian, call it whatever you want to call it, minority inside Israel. We call them Arab Israelis, or some call them Arab citizens of Israel, but they were Arabs. And we did not even talk about Palestinians because we had the other Arabs. There was no occupation, or actually the West Bank was under Jordanian occupation, but we did not refer to the Palestinians. And then came 67, and it took a while, but we had occupation in the West Bank and Gaza. And in the 60s, 70s, 80s, the rise of the Fatah and the PLO and the fact that they tried to achieve their independent state, we started to refer to them after they referred to themselves as Palestinians, but we said, okay, we have Israeli Arabs and those Palestinians who live 1 kilometer to the east, sometimes 1 meter to the east, sometimes east to the border, they are not Palestinians, they are Arabs. It's the same families, and we could lie to ourselves and to say they are not from the same nation. They are from the same nation. And actually, they came, you're right, that it took them time, but they came in 2006 with the what they called the vision statement of the Arab Palestinians of Israel. And we said, we are Palestinian citizens of Israel, Arab Palestinian citizens of Israel. Still, if you ask the average Jewish citizen in Israel, it will tell you they are Arabs Israelis. And this is equivalent to what sometimes many Palestinians in the West Bank, they will call those Palestinians in Israel, they will not call them Palestinian citizens of Israel. They call them Arab el-Dakhel, meaning the Arabs of inside, meaning inside the state, or Arab Tamania Arbaim, meaning Arabs of 48, because Israel came to them in 48. So this is a kind of a mix between the Arab and Palestinian identification. But we must know that in the end of the day, this is the important thing, not if you call them Palestinians or Arabs, that they are part of the same nation who live in the West Bank. It's not different nations.
Let me, I want to ask one more question briefly before we move on. Okay. But Haaretz reported today that the police have arrested 240 Palestinian Israelis because of the recent violence. And it's not clear whether they're treating Jewish rioters and Arab or Palestinian rioters the same way. What is the police behavior in your view?
You know, I know police everywhere. The police that I know the best is the Israeli police. And I'm sorry to say that police is almost everywhere not behaving minorities, not to say national minorities, with a minority that we have a kind of a conflict in the same way like they behave to the majority. Unfortunately, you know, I don't know. Maybe you say that I don't understand. I don't know. I'm not sure that in the U.S. the police behave black the same way they behave to whites. And I think that the gaps here are larger. So without knowing, I'm pretty sure that there are cases that they don't behave in the same way to Jews and Palestinian citizens. By the way, I know Jews from the right wing who say, yeah, they behave to the Palestinians better. Of course, it is not. Maybe you can find some one case, but I'm pretty sure that they don't behave the same. I have heard people who say, okay, the police arrested more Palestinian than Jewish citizens. That fact doesn't say anything, because yes, in this events, I can say that Palestinians were more active than Jews. There was no symmetry, because there is no symmetry here. There is a powerful state with a powerful regime, with a powerful police that is one-sided, and there is a minority. So if the fact that the police arrested more Palestinians than Jews doesn't say anything about that they are behaving to the Palestinians worse than to Jews, but I am sure, without even checking, that this is the situation, like we know from the past.
Let me move on for a moment. The 8 days that Yair Lapid has left to try and form a government, what are the odds? What's going to come out? Will Bennett go with Netanyahu and make him prime minister again? Will there be a different government from left to right, or will there be new elections?
First, I would say all the possibilities are still possible. All these three choices are still possible. According to the law here, like you said, Lapid has 8 more days for his mandate. So in the coming 8 days, there is a possibility that Mr. Lapid would call the president and say, okay, I have a government, and then he has a week until the speaker of the Knesset has to say when the vote about the government is. So it might happen in the coming 8 days. What are the chances? I don't know. It depends. There are actually I see two ways that it's going to happen. One of them is that Mr. Sar, Gideon Sar, is the head of Tikva Chadasha, New Hope, a party with six members of Knesset, six representatives in the Knesset, will say, okay, I agree to be part of a government that is supported by the United List. So United List, you know, that is the Arab list. The chances that it's going to happen are not very high, but I think it is possible. The second possibility is that Naftali Bennett from Yemina, what is Yemina to the right, that his party has actually seven or six seats, depend how you count them, will agree to be and to be the prime minister for 2 years of this government, and then they don't need the support of the United List. The chances are exist. I cannot tell you. It might happen, but maybe 50% or more that it will not happen. Then we still have two possibilities, because according to the law in Israel, if Lapid fails, then the Knesset has 21 days to in order to try to form a government. And then every member of Knesset can try if he has 61 members of Knesset or majority. It doesn't need, or he doesn't need 61, but majority. People go to the sea, it's okay. And in this time, there are actually few possibilities. The first one, that Netanyahu might form a government. He does have chances, I think pretty low, but he does have chances. Second, Lapid will use this addition of 21 more days and form a government, or if all of them fail, we go to fifth elections, which I think is very bad.
First of all, I'd like to remind our listeners, folks that have joined us, the best way to ask a question is by clicking on the Q&A button on the lower right-hand corner of your screen. We've got a lot of comments, not that many questions, but the problem seems to be that you have a pro-Netanyahu and an anti-Netanyahu block of voters, of seats, neither of which has a majority, both of which would require the support of one of the Arab parties, and both contain significant groups that won't accept the support of the Arab parties. So that as long as Israelis don't accept the idea, as long as there's a significant group of Israelis that don't accept the idea of co-government with the Arabs, there can't be a government. It's the way it seems.
That's right. But something had happened in these elections. And, you know, we talk all the time about the bad things, and people ask if I'm optimistic or pessimistic. I'm basically optimistic. Something very fundamental and very positive had happened in the last year. The United List was spread to two lists. This is not positive by itself, but
what we call the joint list, usually here in America.
Joint list. But what they call the United List, which is basically the Islamic movement, is now acceptable. Was, or at least got, the legitimacy of Prime Minister Netanyahu, and actually all the parties in the Knesset, a part of the what they call the religious Zionism, the far right group with only six seats in the Knesset. So if we talk about it, we talked about decades that the Palestinians were, citizens were out of the picture. out of the political map, with no chance to be part of a government. First time they are here, and not only with the anti-Netanyahu group, even with Netanyahu. Actually, Netanyahu could form a coalition, but the far right did not let him do that because of the Islamic movement had to support, or at least to
abstain. That's just the point. The far right, he can't form a government with the four seats of the Islamic movement if the six seats of the radical right won't allow it. So again, you have, and on the other side, you have the whole, at least members of Gideon Saar's New Hope Party that won't join two members of that group, Hendel and Yoaz Hendel, and who's the other one?
Elkin.
It was Hendel, and so they refused to allow the last election round. And so that brought down the thing. It's always those two members that reject the four members. And so the math never, everybody's got 59 seats.
That's right. But in New Hope right now, they say, we accept that. Actually, Netanyahu was the one who made it kosher. Yes, he gave the legitimacy. So they are not saying, you are absolutely right, Hauser and Hendel last year, they said, no, we are not going to be part of that. But today it's different. And I think this is a very positive effect of the fourth elections. And this is why I think it will be great if we can form a coalition, because it's going to be first time since 1992 that Arab Party is part of a coalition. Not necessarily they have a Palestinian minister, maybe they will get some other things. And by the way, we have heard today, and I can confirm that this is a possibility. This is not concluded yet, but I can confirm that this is a possibility that Meretz will have a Palestinian minister too. So this is new game, and it's for me, a person who fought in the last years for Jewish Arab cooperation, I think it's really new hope, if you have to use the name of the party. And even Naftali Bennett, who Yemina, he actually is hesitating right now. And if he comes, there is a coalition, anti-Netanyahu coalition. He didn't say that he refused to sit with the Islamic party. And this is a new game in town. And we have to be very, we have to say the truth that actually it's never happened. In a way, it happened to me to Rabin in 1992. But a part of Rabin, it never happened to any prime minister, not from the Labour and not from other party. And I think that if we manage to do that, this is really a great achievement.
So it seems as though the growing tone of acceptance of the Arab parties is a move toward greater democracy. And at the same time, you have a rising amount of support for the far right, for the Kahanist party, and with it the Lehava, and so that it seems like the balance in democracy is really, democracy is in the balance for Israel right now. You add to that the moves by the Likud and Netanyahu himself to limit the role of the Supreme Court, to tilt the rules in various ways. So is democracy in Israel under threat?
I think democracy, first we have to ask if we have democracy in Israel. I mean, I think we have a kind of a democracy that is partly democracy. There are some strengths in the democracy in Israel, but of course we had the problem of the occupation, we have the problem that in the capital city of Israel, 40% of the residents even don't have the right to vote. And of course, if we talk about questions of religion and state, the fact that I don't really have the democratic way to marry to whom I want, and the thing and questions like that. Even here, I see more optimistic points of view than a pessimistic point of view. You are right that Likud is trying to limit the Supreme Court, but this is exactly what they are trying to do in the last 40 years. And the Supreme Court in Israel is very powerful, very powerful. Just this week, the Supreme Court actually canceled a basic legislation. It's actually like the constitution of Israel. So the Supreme Court is very powerful. And if we talked about this vote for the far right, okay, so they got 5% less than 5% of the votes. If I compare to other states in Europe, in most of them, the far right is unfortunately even stronger. And it's not really new. Those almost many of them were in the previous Knesset. And they were part of Yamina, of Naftali Bennett's party. The new person and the most extreme one, Ben-Gvir and Avi Maoz. Yes, they are very extreme. But we have to remember that they ran to the Knesset in the past. That they got around 2%, 3%, 1.5, whatever. So they did have their support in the past. It's not that they have more support, but it's very bad that they are represented in the Knesset. And
but they were invited in by Netanyahu. So he is essentially, in practice, joined forces, allowed them in, which he's opening the door to anti-democracy.
And I go out of the plenary every time Mr. Ben-Gvir speaks, and he speaks a lot. And you're absolutely right. Mr. Netanyahu is very cynical, yes? Mr. Netanyahu has very clear ideology. According to his clear ideology, Netanyahu has to be the prime minister of Israel. If needed, he would support the far right, and if the far left want to support him and be part of the government, he will be even accept that. If needed, he incite against the Palestinian citizens, like he has done, for example, in 2015, in order to get support. And if needed, he gives them a part in his coalition. This is the main ideology of Netanyahu. He doesn't really support this far right, but he needs them, and he's willing to cooperate with them, and this is very sad.
Question, stepping a little bit further away again, is there still hope for a two-state solution? If not, then there's one state, and then what kind of one state would it be? Essentially, you've got both the Israeli coalition and the Hamas both saying the same thing. They want one state from the river to the sea. They only disagree on exactly how it should be governed.
Right. One state or two states are not part of my ideology. My ideology is freedom. My ideology is peace. My ideology is securing of human rights. And if we have to do that in one state, two states, or seven states, it's not that important. One state or two states is not part of my Zionism. My Zionism says I am part of the right of the Jewish people to implement, or actually to the national rights of the Jewish nation or the Jewish people, And it might be in one state, in two states, in binational states, everything is okay. It's part of the Zionism. So what I have to check is what is possible, one state or two states. In the illusions, one state is way better, everything is nice, and we live together in peace and equality. But there are a few problems with that. The first one is exactly like you've said, when Hamas and Ben-Gvir are talking about one state, they're talking about one apartheid state, one state of Jewish supremacy or Palestinian supremacy or Muslim supremacy. They don't talk about democracy. Second, there are many people, there are minority on both sides, that do talk about one state and believe really that it is possible to have one democratic state. I don't think that it is possible in the coming future. Why? First, you know, we saw this model in Yugoslavia and other places. You cannot have two nations fighting for 100 years and then operating together in one state in one after one night of signing an agreement. But there are two main things that are even way more deepening that. The first one is, I have said that I support human rights. And I think that there is one right that it is not part of the human rights. I don't think that an American or a European will take it as human rights, but for Palestinians and Israelis, it is human right, and this is the right of return. My grandfather had the right to come here after 1900s, that he was in exile or whatever, in Kurdistan, in Iraq. He had the right to return. And this is Zionism, yes? This is all Zionism about. So I cannot tell others, okay, my grandfather had the right to return after 1900 years, and you don't have the right to return after 74 years. No, it's not possible. So how can we manage that? We cannot manage in one state having a return of the Palestinians, refugees to one state, because one state has one person, one vote, and the majority will not accept it. And then you did not answer to the Palestinians' needs. So the only way to do that is in two states, that the Palestinians go to Palestine and Jews who come from abroad, come to Israel and not to the occupied territories. And the last point is that the economic gaps are so big that I cannot imagine a state living like that. In Israel, the average income is $43,000 a year. It's somewhere in the middle of Europe, yes, more than France and even more than UK right now. In Palestine, it's more than 2,000. How can you combine two societies like that? I cannot see that happen. So from all these reasons, I don't think that one state is possible. The only solution I see right now is two states. Now, one can tell me, yes, but what are we going to do with the settlers? This is a real problem. This is a real problem, and we have to think about mechanism, how to deal with that. For example, I can start with Geneva Initiative. I believe many of you know. The other I really suggest to Google Geneva Initiative, and you can see that with some swap of land, we can have, instead of 700,000 Israelis living east to the Green Line, we will have to deal with 160,000. Second, maybe we can have more sweeps, not only land sweeps. For example, Israel can give Palestine gas field in the sea and get some settlements. Or maybe we can agree that settlers will stay in Palestine under Palestinian sovereignty and in a kind of a return, Israel will accept the same number of refugees. So we can think about a possibilities how to solve that, because yes, I agree that there is no way to move 700,000 settlers, and even not 100,000. So we will have to update our view of the future agreement regarding this problem. And we will have to pay because of the settlements, right?
I'm looking at some of the questions that are coming in from our crowd here. And David Ehrlich asks, what is the likely legal outcome on Sheikh Jarrah?
Wow. Okay, great question. Because I'm not sure that people really understand. I'll try to be to give the details in a very simple way, so it will be just 90% accurate. Basically, Sheikh Jarrah is a neighborhood north to the old city of Jerusalem, east to the center of Jerusalem, in what we call today East Jerusalem. Sheikh Jarrah was first populated by Palestinians in 1860, 160 years ago. I think about 20 or 30 years later, some Jewish community in Jerusalem came and buy some assets and used to live there. So it was a kind of a neighborhood that was with a Palestinian majority and with a Jewish minority. Before the establishment of the state in 1948, clashes there were very violent, like in many other places in the state of Israel, Palestine, call it whatever you want to call it. And in the 40s, like we had about 700,000 Palestinian refugees who left Israel, there were about 2,000 Jewish refugees, if you call them refugees, who came from what had to be the Palestinian state or the Arab state to Israel. They came from Sheikh Jarrah, they came from Silwan, they came from the Zion Block, from Neve Yaakov, from Beit Arava. Not really important where from, but few of them, tens of them, came from Sheikh Jarrah, and they were actually they were compensated by the Israeli government. And actually, the Israeli law said that refugees who left the state, those 700,000 Palestinian refugees, cannot come back, and their property is a part of the government property and went to Jews. The Jordanians, by the way, has done the same. Sheikh Jarrah stayed from 48 to 67 under Jordanian, I would say occupation, because this occupation was recognized only by UK and Pakistan, the only two states in the world that recognized the Jordanian occupation. And they settled some of the refugees who came from West Jerusalem and from other parts of Israel in Sheikh Jarrah. It was in 1952. They didn't know that 15 years later, Israel will occupy this neighborhood. Then came 67, but now Israel went and actually, 6 days war, Israel occupied West Jerusalem, but only in the late 80s, Jews started to take assets in Sheikh Jarrah and in other places in East Jerusalem. How did they do that? There are two laws that are actually letting this situation. I will not refer to them exactly, but basically, if my friend, Michael Ben-Yair, Michael Ben-Yair was the legal advisor of Rabin's government, that he was for a year a judge in the Supreme Court in Israel. He was born in Sheikh Jarrah. If he wants to have his house back, or even if his grandchild wants it, he can do that. He can do that because he is Jewish, and only because he's Jewish. Why I'm saying that? Because the same apartment or the same place that was owned by Ben Yair before 48, now live there a Palestinian. And this Palestinian is a refugee who came from Israel. And he says, okay, you're right. Ben Yair wants to live here, nice. So please let me live in my apartment, in my house, in West Jerusalem or Tzrifin or whatever. But of course, the law here is actually very one-sided law. The law is letting that only to Jews in East Jerusalem and doesn't let it to Palestinians, not in West Jerusalem, nor in the other parts of the state. Right now, the Supreme Court, according to this very problematic law, or I would say the court, not the Supreme Court, the court, according to this problematic law, approved eviction of 8 Palestinian families from May 2nd. And this started the violence that actually we protest in Sheikh Jarrah in the last 12 years every week because families started to be thrown out from their homes 12 years ago. And right now they approved 8 to take out from their homes evictions for 8 families, and they apply to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court is going to deal with that in the coming weeks. So right now the police cannot throw them out, but it's very close.
Now and the question on it's often argued here by pro-Israel advocates that it's a real estate question. It's a question, it's an argument over who owns which houses and which plots of land. It seems to me, and it's looked for a couple of years, as though it was primarily settler activists who were trying to reclaim property in Sheikh Jarrah in order to advance the notion of Israeli sovereignty over captured territory.
Right. First, I think I'm pro-Israeli, and the one who claimed that is anti-Israeli. Not only anti-democracy, he is anti-Israeli, because what he says actually, one of two possibilities, if you say that Jews can go back to their assets, to these 8, we talk about 8 apartments, yes, in Sheikh Jarrah, because it's only a question of real estate, now you have to tell me, what about these 700,000 Palestinians who used to live here? They are now way more than 7. Can they take their real estate? Can they take the? If you say no, so you say there is a Jewish supremacy. Jews can buy real estate or take the real estate, and Palestinian no. If you say yes, so actually what do you say? All the millions of Palestinians can come back to Israel, and this is the end of Israel as a Jewish and democratic state. So I think that one who claimed that, including the government, this is anti-Israel, it is not pro-Israel.
So the next question, Marcia Yerman and Dan Fleshler want to know what the odds are of a confederation, essentially 2 states within a single state. Can that work? Is there a rule for it?
Probably the answer is yes. First, you have to have the 2 states, and then they have to create this confederation. I am really supporting that. You have to think about what is a confederation? Do we know from the present confederations? Maybe Europe is a kind of confederation. If this is a confederation, I fully support. But we have to think about the details, not only about the title. Are we going to have one army to the confederation? I'll be very happy. I don't see it happen in the coming future. I'd be very happy, really. But it's not going to happen in the coming future. But the other institutions, like even one parliament or things like that, I will be very happy if Palestinians and Israelis agree. Great.
Now, Paul Parker is asking whether the Geneva Initiative, the Geneva Agreement, disadvantages Palestinians. Is it really equally fair to the Israel and Palestine, the way that the Geneva Agreement is constructed?
Yeah, I think so. This is why many Palestinians and many Israelis support that. Actually, the Geneva Initiative is actually taking what happened in the Arab League Peace Initiative in 2002, March 28, 2002. The Arab League Peace Initiative, 22 Arab states said, we want peace and normalization with Israel. If Israel withdraw from the lands it occupied in 1967, and find a just and agreed solution to the questions, to the question of refugees. And actually, Geneva Initiative is elaborating that into details. By the way, the Arab League said later, a few years later, I think it was 9 years later, that they accept swapping lands in proportion of one to one, meaning
Israel. 2013 under Kerry in Washington.
Yes, in Kerry, Washington, but I think it was approved earlier in the Arab League summit. I think it was 2011, but maybe 13. I don't really remember. So the Geneva Initiative actually was launched on December 1st, 2003, almost 2 years later, is based on that. Is based on what the Arab League nations said. And by the way, it's not only the Arab League nations, it's that all the Islamic nations, they sat in Tehran in 2003 and said, we accept that. All the, I think, 53 or 57 Islamic nations. So Geneva is, yes, I think, you know, nothing is 100% fair, but it is fair.
I guess the final question, it's the polls until recently, the Israel Democracy Poll Institute and Khalil Shikaki's poll, they ran a poll together. And for years, it showed that there's a majority, sometimes a slim one, sometimes a greater one, in favor of a two-state solution on both sides. But each side believes that the other side doesn't really want it. And the notion is that Abu Mazen, Mahmoud Abbas, the head of the Palestinian Authority, is not a partner for peace and actually aims to dismantle Israel in the end.
Yes. When late President Sadat, the Egyptian president, came to Israel in 1977, he said that 90% of the conflict between between Egypt and Israel was psychological. And they think, in a way, this is part of the conflict here. Israelis don't trust Palestinians, and Palestinians don't trust Israelis. There are very good reasons not to trust each other. For example, we had the Oslo Accords, and Israel and the Palestinians cheated the other side all the time. I can give you Israeli violations, and it is not easy to me to say because it was Rabin as prime minister, but I can elaborate about Israeli violations from the very first day, and I can elaborate about Palestinians' violations from the very first day. And I again, it is not, I'm not happy to say that because I want to promote, you know, peace and understanding between the two sides, but this is one of the reasons why we can trust each other. And the second is our narratives. We live in a narrative that we are the victims and they are the aggressors. You hear what people are talking about here. Israel is very powerful, but the Hamas wants to kill us, to kill all of us. And for example, this in the last 2 weeks, but I can give examples from the past, of course, too. In those 2 weeks, 13 people in Israel were killed. By the way, some of the Palestinian citizens of Israel, three of them are foreign workers, but 13 people in Israel were killed. And I think the number is 260 in Gaza, among them 64, I think, kids. The media in Israel was, by the way, the media is always very extreme, but I never saw it like that. The media was 24 hours a day in the three main TV channels only about the conflicts. No movies, no series, nothing. No sport, nothing. Just about the conflict. News and news and news and news. And again and again and again, the news are, we are suffering. A missile hit on a car, a missile hit an apartment, elaborating only about the Israeli suffer. And there is Israeli suffer, of course. We suffered. There were people who were killed. There were people who were injured. There were people who lost their properties. There were people, many of us, even majority, who didn't go to work, who had to stay with the kids, and the kids were afraid. Yes, Israeli suffered, of course. But never mentioning the Palestinians suffered. Never mentioning the fact that in the other side, 64 kids were killed. Never mentioning that women and civilians were killed in the other side. And if you are, if this is the kind of news that you consume every day, you start to believe that you are the victim and they are the aggressors, while the truth is not there. The truth is somewhere in the middle. And the same with the Palestinians, by the way. And in this way, it's not a surprise that they don't trust the other side. You disappeared, AJ? JJ, do you hear me? I understand that you hear me and see me, but I don't hear anybody. Don't see anybody. Don't know what happened. Okay. Wait, Lenny, I see you and hear you, yes.
Okay, so I think we lost JJ.
Okay.
I don't know if you had completed what you wanted to say.
Yes, I did.
Because our time, it's now 2 o'clock US time and it's 9 o'clock your time. So I want to thank you, Mosi, and I want to thank JJ as well. I hope he will come back to receive the thanks, and I want to thank everyone who has joined us for really a very stimulating conversation.
Thank you for listening and for inviting me.
Yes, and thanks to the staff of Partners for Progressive Israel for their work in making this discussion happening. We hope you've enjoyed it, and we're glad to be bringing this program to all of you for free. If you want to learn more about our upcoming programming, please visit our website, progressiveisrael.org, and while you're there, please make a contribution. That is what enables us to bring programs like this to you at no cost. Thank you, and thank everyone for attending. Stay safe.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.